Good afternoon, good morning, welcome to this Telenews conference sponsored by the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Southern Alliance for Clean Energy is on the web at www.cleanenergy.org. Again, that's cleanenergy.org. That's where you will be able to find a news release related to today's news event. You'll be hearing today from a total of four speakers. I'm going to go through them in a moment as a group and then individually as they deliver their remarks, but what I'd like to do first is invite the operator on the line to explain to you how it is that members of the news media may participate during the Q&A period that will follow the opening statements.
During the question and answer session, you may ask a question by pressing star, then one on your touch-tone phone. If you would like to remove yourself from the queue, you may press star, then two. Again, it's star, then one to ask a question.
And we'll be repeating those instructions at the start of the Q&A period. At this time, I'd like to introduce the four speakers who will be participating during the news conference. You'll be hearing, first of all, from Southern Alliance for Clean Energy Program Director Sarah Barzak. She will be followed by our second speaker, Edwin Lyman, who is Senior Scientist in the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists in Washington, D.C. Our third speaker today will be former Nuclear Regulatory Commission member Peter Bradford, who is an adjunct professor at Vermont Law School and also a former chair of the New York and Maine Utility Commissions. And our fourth speaker today will be Henry Sokolsky, who is executive director of the Nonproliferation Policy Education Center and former resident fellow at the National Institute for Public Policy, the Heritage Foundation, and the Hoover Institution. We'll turn now to our first speaker, first of four speakers, Southern Alliance for Clean Energy Program Director, Sarah Barzak.
Thank you for joining us for this news event today. I'm Sarah Barzak, Program Director of Southern Alliance for Clean Energy's High-Risk Energy Choices Program. I'm very pleased that so many distinguished speakers have joined us for this SACE news conference. We are here today to urge that the Energy Department immediately halt plans to issue taxpayer-backed loan guarantees in wake of major NRC safety objections to the Westinghouse reactor design. The NRC action further underscores the seriousness of a multi-billion dollar bailout risk to taxpayers. Beyond the question of loan guarantees, the very future of 14 of 25 planned reactors that would use the flawed AP1000 design are now in jeopardy. And that includes a lot of reactors right here in the Southeast, where SACE is based: North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, and Alabama. Nationwide, that's over half of all proposed reactors now at risk. And for some quick background, the Department of Energy plans to issue nuclear loan guarantees, quote-unquote, soon, according to Energy Secretary Chu. These guarantees are part of the DOE's Title 17 Loan Guarantee Program. Two of the four nuclear reactor projects that the DOE is reported to be considering for taxpayer-backed loan guarantees are AP1000 design proposed by the Southern Company at the Vogtle site in Georgia and the South Carolina Electric and Gas VC Summer site. However, the NRC has made it clear that there are doubts if the AP1000 nuclear reactor structure can withstand hurricanes, earthquakes, tornadoes, and other external impacts as required by their regulations. What we are saying is very simple. This alarming situation in which one federal agency hand does not seem to know what the other federal agency hand is doing needs to end. With billions of taxpayer dollars at stake in the proposed nuclear loan guarantees, the Department of Energy owes it to the public to get on the same page as the Nuclear Regulatory Commission about these serious AP1000 reactor design problems. We believe that the Energy Department should assure the public that utilities considering problematic nuclear reactor designs, such as the AP1000, should not qualify for these loan guarantees. Otherwise, the Energy Department is ignoring the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's warning and deliberately putting taxpayer dollars at considerable risk. We are further concerned that, much like the Department of Energy, state regulatory agencies in the Southeast are not considering the serious information from the NRC about the design flaws with the reactor design. Most recently, with last Friday's vote by the Florida Public Service Commission to approve Florida Power and Light and Progress Energy's scheme to charge customers hundreds of millions of dollars for construction costs through an early cost recovery mechanism to pay for four new reactors with projected construction costs of more than $34 billion. SACE intervened, and one of our expert witnesses, Mr. Arnold Gunderson, a nuclear engineer, testified to delay concerns, including issues with the AP1000. He actually testified that the proposed new reactor projects would experience construction delays and cost overruns in the future that will negatively impact Floridians, and that these delays were not properly accounted for by either utility. And then the NRC news comes out about the AP1000 safety concerns last week, and it's as if Mr. Gunderson had a crystal ball. Yet the Florida PSC still goes forward with their vote to put Florida families and businesses on the hook for troubled new reactors. We are concerned that other public utility commissions in Georgia and South Carolina and elsewhere are likely to also make the same bad decisions in spite of this new information from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. To make matters worse, if the Department of Energy awards these proposed nuclear loan guarantees to utilities pursuing these problematic designs, they'll be putting American taxpayers on the hook. So utility customers and taxpayers will all be stuck paying for something that has clearly been shown to have major problems. Our question is, when is this going to stop? When are ratepayers and taxpayers going to be protected? We believe that the first obvious step is for the Department of Energy to halt issuance of these conditional nuclear loan guarantees. This has been outlined in a group letter sent to Secretary of Energy Chu earlier this week. Thank you. That concludes my opening statement.
That was the opening statement of our first speaker, Southern Alliance for Clean Energy Program Director Sarah Barzak, Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. On the web at cleanenergy.org, that's where you can find a related news release that summarizes the points being made in today's news conference. Let's proceed now to our second speaker, Edwin Lyman, Senior Scientist with the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists in Washington, D.C.
Good afternoon. I'd just like to discuss a little bit of the technical background regarding the safety issues with the AP1000. And then talk a little bit about how my organization, the Union of Concerned Scientists, interprets this event and make some recommendations. So first of all, the unlike conventional operating pressurized water reactors today, the AP1000 has a different type of containment structure. Instead of having a monolithic reinforced concrete containment that's supposed to protect against both things that could happen from the inside, like a steam explosion, or things that could threaten the reactor from the outside, like high winds or a tornado. The AP1000 has a steel shell as its containment to protect from these events from the inside, and a reinforced concrete shield building, which is designed to protect that containment and other reactor structures from external events. Now, the AP1000 received a design certification from the NRC, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, in 2005, and that was based on the shield building being a conventional reinforced concrete structure, which is something that is a well-understood object. However, Westinghouse later submitted an amendment to that design certification. And part of that amendment was to, what they said, enhance the shield building, partly to protect against aircraft attack, anticipating that NRC would actually have a new regulation that new reactors have some requirement to protect themselves against a September 11th type aircraft attack. And so, but in redesigning the shield building, Westinghouse actually made significant changes to the whole philosophy by which that building would be constructed. In fact, went from a reinforced concrete structure to a hybrid that would have some reinforced concrete, but would also have what are known as steel concrete composite modules, which are essentially steel shells that would be stapled onto the concrete frame and then filled with concrete. And this is a considerable change to the way this type of building is constructed. And what happened is Westinghouse actually undermined its own design certification by making the significant suggested change to the way the building would be constructed. Now, it's not clear why it was necessary to do that, but one can surmise that it had to do with concern about reducing the cost of building this large concrete structure. Now, NRC, in the letter last week, rejected this design approach, actually saying that the design needed to be changed, and that it was unclear. Westinghouse simply had not provided the analysis and testing necessary to demonstrate that this type of modular construction would actually be able to protect against external events like earthquakes, hurricanes, etc. And even worse, it turns out that the way they were proposing to construct this was not in accordance with U.S. codes and standards for building construction. They were proposing that the steel shells actually be given credit as a reinforcing steel, and it turns out there is no U.S. code that would approve that kind of a use. So they were seeking an unapproved standard. And so my interpretation of this is, first of all, that NRC's licensing approach is very ineffective. The fact is that all the reactor applicants who have referenced the AP1000 in their applications for a construction operating license are dependent on the resolution of these design questions before those applications can really be credibly reviewed. And so we simply think that it does not make sense for any reactor applicant to reference a design that has not first been certified or one whose certification has been called into question, as is the case with the AP1000. My other conclusion would be that NRC, to its credit, seems to be holding its ground in the face of significant pressure to accelerate licensing reviews. And I think this episode illustrates why it would be dangerous as for some in Congress to actually introduce legislation that would accelerate design reviews, forcing the NRC to dispose of these very complicated technical issues associated with novel design features and novel construction methods, legislation that could actually force them to speed up their reviews. These procedures and technical reviews really take time, and the regulatory agency needs to have all the documentation it needs to actually fully understand these detailed technical issues. And a political mandate to artificially accelerate these reviews could be potentially disastrous and lead to the construction of a new generation of nuclear plants with fatal design flaws built into them, essentially ticking time bombs. So we certainly believe this illustrates the foolhardy nature of some of the proposals in Congress to what they call streamline NRC licensing reviews. So in conclusion, we believe that this change that Westinghouse has proposed puts the design at considerable risk. Westinghouse itself did say over the summer that if the NRC required additional testing, that it would lead to significant delays. In fact, that is exactly what NRC is requiring. So Westinghouse, according to Westinghouse's own words, this will be a significant delay to the project, and that means big risk both with regard to safety and with regard to taxpayer exposure. Thank you.
That was the opening statement of our second speaker, Edwin Lyman, Senior Scientist with the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. We'll now proceed to our third of four speakers. He is Peter Bradford, an adjunct professor at Vermont Law School, a former Nuclear Regulatory Commission member, and former chair of the New York and Maine Utility Commissions.
Thanks, Scott. The point I want to emphasize is that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's concerns about safety of the Toshiba Westinghouse AP1000 design are only the latest illustration of the very high costs to which federal loan guarantees would expose U.S. taxpayers. Already in the last 18 months, more than half of the 26 nuclear reactors that the industry has said constituted the nuclear renaissance have been canceled or have been delayed more than a year, or have experienced an upward cost revision of more than $1 billion. These events predate the announcements concerning the AP1000. These delays are very likely to increase the costs of the plants, turning some of them into economic white elephants of the sort with which the nuclear industry already has considerable experience. In anticipation of such an outcome, the industry has been seeking unprecedented federal loan guarantees to assure that the risks associated with new reactors will this time be borne by the taxpayers. If these disappointing Renaissance projects had been covered by loan guarantees today, taxpayers would already be exposed to the bills. This would be particularly true for projects in states like Maryland and Texas, where costs must now be recovered in competitive power markets. Such markets make no provision for recovery of the cost of delay. Such costs would normally fall on investors and lenders in a free enterprise system, giving project management every incentive to limit and to manage risks. If taxpayers instead are forced by Congress to assume these risks, management's reluctance to run risks, like the submission of incomplete designs, is reduced by the fact that the costs of any default will be paid by the U.S. government. Design risks like those experienced by Toshiba Westinghouse are far from the largest source of taxpayer exposure. Half of all of the reactors ever licensed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission since its origin were canceled prior to completion, some after expenditures of more than $1 billion. Many other reactors experienced 9- and 10-figure cost overruns prior to completion. A few plants, notably Three Mile Island, malfunctioned ruinously and had to be closed early or shut down for more than a year. Finally, the evolution of cheaper power generation technologies confronted the electric industry with well over $100 billion in stranded nuclear investment in the 1990s, which had to be reclaimed in a surcharge on customer bills. All of these events could trigger taxpayer liability under an expanded nuclear loan guarantee framework. Relieving investors, lenders, and reactor vendors of every incentive to reduce and manage risks presents exactly the moral hazard concern that Congress continues to grapple with in trying to reform the regulation of the nation's financial system. To expand the exposure of taxpayers from failures in banks, insurance companies, and the auto industry to the builders of unneeded reactors would be fiscal irresponsibility on a truly breathtaking scale. That concludes my prepared statement.
That was the opening statement of our third speaker, Nuclear Regulatory Commission member Peter Bradford, an adjunct professor at Vermont Law School and former chair of the New York and Maine Utility Commissions. That takes us to our fourth and final speaker before the Q&A period begins. He is Henry Sikulski, Executive Director of the Nonproliferation Policy Education Center.
Well, thank you for having me on this. The only thing I would add to my resume is I currently serve on a commission that Congress created. I was appointed by the Republican leadership, the Commission on the Prevention of Weapons of Mass Destruction, Proliferation, and Terrorism. This will come up at the end of my presentation again because they made a recommendation that bears directly on this kind of train wreck of events. My center has been interested in the economics of nuclear energy because if we fund it when it doesn't make economic sense and keep pushing it, it becomes very difficult to tell other countries not to do likewise. And we want to make sure that everything makes sense if we do it, and certainly if we spend public money on it. In this regard, I think we're in a bit of trouble, and it's not entirely surprising. I think actually what we're talking about today should be yet another cautionary tale of what happens when our government gets into pushing commercial energy projects, especially those that run, like nuclear does, inherent safety and financial risks. When you do this, it distorts all of the incentives industry has to protect the taxpayer and the consumer physically and financially. Now, let me explain something. A lot of people, they think of the AP1000. I don't know what they think. It's a reactor for sure, but it's one we actually paid for even before it got built. Most people don't know it, but our Congress has appropriated over the last decade or so $300+ million and given it to Westinghouse to design what is a commercial reactor. It was very unusual in that normally DOE does research and development. This had virtually nothing to do with research and development, but we did this because we wanted to be supportive of the nuclear industry. So we did that. That should have been a warning right there. You really should only do R&D. Then the Department of Energy, having realized that they spent a bundle of money, felt and were pressured by Congress to feel guilty. So then they said, well, what we'll do is we'll give you your money back once we sell this reactor, or I should say Westinghouse sells the reactor. We'll attach fees, and we'll capture the rents and give you your money back. This then produced a very perverse incentive to sell this thing. So what happened is the Chinese said, hey, we're interested in this. And then all of a sudden it became very, very imperative that the licensing process be rushed. Why? Well, you couldn't quite sell this thing unless it was somehow certified by somebody. So they rushed that, and they caught that sale. In fact, as we speak, they're building some of these things in China. It was a big sale. It was like worth $8 billion. So then, having moved forward in that regard, there was pressure to take care of some of the other obstacles to making these things attractive for building. So in 2005, we had a bill, and it helped to secure insurance against regulatory delays, cost overrun support worth $2 billion, hundreds of millions in production tax credits for nuclear, and what's left? Well, nobody wants to finance these things, so you got to get the government to finance them. These are where the loan guarantees come in. Now, you put all this together, and what's amazing isn't that they ran into this problem with the AP1000, but that it didn't occur multiple times earlier. And I think what we're going to see if we continue to put loan guarantees on these projects, which essentially means that you screw up, you're covered. If you do that, there won't be much discipline in industry to not screw up. There'll be less. What is lacking in all of this, and this is a point which I highlighted yesterday in a National Review Online piece about Obama bribing a few senators who are Republican to vote for cap and trade with loan guarantees for nuclear. What I highlighted there is the point that if you don't have people with private money either hoping they'll get rich or frightened they're going to go to the poorhouse if the project screws up, you're really not going to have any discipline over these projects so that they land on their feet. But what does this recommend? I think pretty much what the other speakers said. There ought to be a moratorium on loan guarantees or any other further financial incentives from the government for nuclear. This is a point which actually the Heritage Foundation, where I used to work, recently endorsed regarding the loan guarantees for nuclear. It's an idea clearly my center endorses, and it's one that our commission just yesterday endorsed in a progress report on the government. And what it said is, we really have to worry a little about what Congress is going to do with regard to financial incentives. We said in our report, one of the final recommendations was that the government should discourage the use of such financial incentives for nuclear power to the extent possible. The second thing and the last thing which we need to do, and I think the other speakers have raised it, is to condition the release of any of the existing loan guarantees on any reactors until they're fully licensed. Anyway, I think if we don't do these sorts of things, I would expect that we're going to be meeting on this phone in the future, maybe not repeatedly, but with some frequency, because the incentives are not pushed in the direction to get the job done right. And all the incentives are pushing the other direction. So need to fix this. That concludes my remarks.
That was the opening statement of our fourth and final speaker before the Q&A period begins. His name is Henry Sokolsky, Executive Director of the Non-Proliferation Policy Education Center, former resident fellow at the National Institute for Public Policy, the Heritage Foundation, and the Hoover Institution. That takes us now to the Q&A period, and what we'd like to do as we move into the Q&A period is invite the operator back on the line to explain how it is that members of the news media can pose their questions. And I do want to emphasize that the Q&A period will be reserved for members of the media. Operator?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone. If you decide to withdraw your question, please press star then two to remove yourself from the list. Please limit yourself to one question and a single follow-up. If you need to ask an additional question, please know that you may press star then one to rejoin the queue.
And we will have the operator back on the line as necessary during the Q&A period to repeat the instructions about how it is that you can pose your questions. We do want to encourage you to take advantage of this opportunity to interact with the four experts that we've gathered for you today. We do understand that some of you will want to pose your questions after the news event, and we'll explain as we proceed how it is that we can facilitate that in the wake of this news conference. Also want to emphasize that the news release that summarizes the points made by the four speakers is available to you now on the website of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy at cleanenergy.org. Again, that's cleanenergy.org. And operator, understand that we do have a question. Let's proceed with the first one.
The first question comes from Sean Higgins of Investors Daily. Please go ahead.
Investors Business Daily, actually. I was curious if anybody there had any comment or reaction on the joint op-ed by Senators Kerry and Graham that ran in the New York Times last week. They touted nuclear and specifically called for streamlining regulations regarding them.
Well, this is Peter Bradford. Regulation has already been streamlined to the point where there's really nothing constructive left for the Congress to do. You know, the NRC has extensively revised its licensing process to provide for the system in which each vendor can get a design like the AP1000 pre-approved. The theory was then that companies would submit applications that referenced the pre-approved design. And what's happened now isn't that the licensing process as such is holding things up. What's happened is that the package of incentives that Congress created for new reactors caused, in essence, a gold rush in which the would-be builders came crowding through the NRC's doors in great numbers before the end of 2008 deadline and before the reference designs had been fully reviewed and approved. It's not that they were going slowly. It's that Congress triggered a rush of individual applications before that review process had been completed. So what you've got now is a bunch of applications to build plants based on reference designs that not only haven't been approved yet, but that, as in the case of the AP1000, clearly have some problems that need to be ironed out. Congress can't do anything constructive about that. It's a process that's going to have to be sorted out by serious review of the problems that Ed Lyman mentioned. And the individual applications are going to have to proceed on a schedule that allows for the generic designs to be properly and safely reviewed. The NRC has also put in place a number of much more unfortunate modifications in terms of exclusions of the public from effective participation in its processes. But because they've already done that, there's nothing left for the Congress to mandate in that area either.
This is Henry Sokolsky. There's a tendency in Congress, I worked on the Hill for 8 years, there's a tendency to kind of try to pressurize the regulatory system by making statements like this. But roughly, two comments. This thing about streamlining suggests that we've learned nothing and we've forgotten nothing. It is a standard argument for why nuclear power hasn't succeeded and been financially attractive and all that. You got to wonder at what point it just no longer becomes the case. And if anything, this recent pickup would suggest that haste makes waste, and this is the time to kind of slow down and take a look and ask deeper questions about what's troubling this industry.
Sorry, this is Ed Lyman again. Just like to reiterate what I already said, which is that we think the regulations have already been streamlined beyond what's appropriate, and that this incident should hopefully give Congress pause in it demonstrates that the NRC is not the villain here, and the regulations are not the villain, but it's the industry and the vendors which are undermining themselves by trying to make these last-minute significant design changes, knowing full well that what they're doing has significant technical uncertainties. So it's really the burden of the vendors and the fact that their applications have been incomplete and inadequate that is the largest source of any of what's taking the licensing reviews or what's leading to these lengthy licensing reviews.
This is Sarah Barzak with Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. I also, in direct response to your question, I also think it's important to highlight that Senator Lindsey Graham is from South Carolina. That is where the SCENG VC Summer plant is, where they are proposing two new reactors, and they are one of the front runners for these nuclear loan guarantees. I also think it's important to note.
That was part of the reason why they were supporting it.
Exactly. And that's also, you know, the Southeast as a region has a huge number of reactor projects, many of them being the AP1000 design. So there's obviously a political reason why Mr. Graham, Senator Graham, has come forward with, you know, wanting nuclear to be on the table. His fellow colleagues in Congress will directly benefit.
Operator, in the interest of making sure everyone has the opportunity to pose a question, we've got a number of them backed up. Let's move on, and we'll make sure anybody who has a follow-up also gets into the queue. So, Operator, let's proceed.
The next question comes from Elaine Hiruo of Platts. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My question is for Edwin Lyman. Ed, would you, and I tried to understand when you were talking about the revision that essentially led to this problem. It sounded like they started taking steel out of containment. Would you kind of give me a synopsis on that again, please?
Sure. The way I understand it, the original shield building design was again a conventional, you know, reinforced concrete structure where you have steel reinforcing bars that are embedded in concrete. Now, what the revision to the design proposed was that some of that reinforced concrete would be taken out and replaced by structures which are called modules, which would essentially be steel liner plates that would be filled with concrete like a sandwich, and that these would be it wouldn't be one monolithic structure, but these would be attached together with some sort of anchorage to each other and to the base of concrete. And so it, because of that, you're going from a single monolithic structure to an assemblage of these modules. And that raises a lot of issues because it's simply not clear whether that combination would have the same ability to resist external impacts as the original design. In fact, it's a novel approach which is not approved. Again, there are no codes and standards which say you can even, there's a code for how you can actually justify that in the United States. And just to take one safety issue, if you have conventional structure where you have steel which is embedded in concrete, if there's a fire, the concrete acts to protect the steel from the heat. It provides a fire barrier, but in this case, the steel is on the outside. So it could be a situation where the steel itself would start to deform because of the fire, and you lose structural strength that way. So that's just one of many, many issues that stem from the difference in these designs. And Westinghouse tried to really sneak this through, and the NRC, to its credit, has came up with an extensive list of questions that hadn't been answered.
Mm-hmm. A follow-up, if I may, then. I thought I heard you say that perhaps one reason this would perhaps lower its cost, going this as opposed to the monolithic structure.
Yeah, I mean, that's just speculation that since they did have to increase the structural strength of the building to resist aircraft impact perhaps this is a way they envision that could offset the cost of that increase. Now, I don't know. I don't know anything about the cost numbers, but I assume they wouldn't be making this kind of change if there weren't a good reason. And cost, you know, it's the best reason these days because, as you know, the capital cost of the AP 1000 is already through the roof, and I'm sure they're trying every way possible to get those costs down.
The next question, operator?
Yes, the next question comes from William Harrington of Inside Washington Publishers. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking these calls. My first question is, you know, what have you gleaned from the Department of Energy statements that, you know, they're expected to soon issue the first set of conditional loan guarantees? And then a follow-up to that would be, given that they don't become final until a new reactor is approved by the NRC, you know, why are these conditional loan guarantees so problematic in your eyes, given that they don't really come into force until, you know, presumably the issues with the AP1000 would be resolved, if indeed they are?
Well, let me take – it's Peter Bradford. Let me take the second part first. It's clear that the problems with the AP1000 are going to cause delays, and delays are expensive and contribute to cost overruns. To the extent you have cost overruns that result either in costs that aren't recoverable in power markets in states like Maryland or Texas, or that result in disallowances for imprudence by utilities commissions in the regulated states in the Southeast, you have exactly the kind of losses that have the potential to trigger loan guarantee obligations. So the mere fact that the loan guarantee is in some sense conditional doesn't avoid the delays, and once you've got the delays, you've got the costs and the cost overruns that can trigger the loan guarantees. And the fact that the loan guarantees are called conditional doesn't solve that problem at all. I mean, the whole concept of conditional loan guarantees is more than a little strange in itself. That is, why not wait until you can give a real loan guarantee and not worry about the conditions? But that's really beside the point of your question.
Well, I think that last statement, this is Henry Sokolsky, suggests, you know, why industry likes this. It's because it gets the cart of the project ahead of proper due diligence necessary to make it worth a candle to begin with. And so what you do is you get the monster going and you drag people into the vortex of feeling pressure to say it's okay. I mean, that is exactly what happened in this case. You know, they had to move these things out. They had to streamline things to get the export out to China. All systems had to be go. I mean, it's a testimony to the independence of the Regulatory Commission that they blew a whistle on this. It was tremendous pressure not to, I'm sure.
And the on the statement that the DOE is getting ready to issue the first ones?
They should slow down.
No, I'm sorry. But where do you get the indication that DOE will, in the next, like, you know, in the immediate future, will soon issue some of these conditional loan guarantees?
Well, Secretary Chu has said as much. I don't have a citation in front of me, but within the last 2 weeks.
Operator, let's proceed to our next question.
The next question comes from Pete Baer of Climate Wire. Please go ahead.
Thanks for the session. Coming back to the loan guarantees and the conditionality, is the problem here that the conditional approval creates momentum toward a final approval, or because there couldn't be any actual obligation of taxpayer guarantees until DOE made final approval on the loan guarantees and the design was approved, correct?
Well,
so in other words, is this a problem of a the camel's nose in the tent, or do you think that the conditional approvals could actually obligate the taxpayer?
It's both.
And
This is Peter Bradford. It's both. Let's say that you get a loan guarantee that's conditioned on your getting an NRC license. Now, I think the thrust of your question is, okay, so you have a problem with the AP1000, you don't get a license, no taxpayer exposure. But that's not really the way it will work, or that's really the way it may work. What may well happen is that the problem will take 2 or 3 years to resolve, or at least 2 or 3 years before the resolution plays its way out through the individual licensing proceedings. So at the end of the day, the project will in fact have their NRC license, and therefore will have, the condition will be fulfilled, the loan guarantee will kick in. But meanwhile, because of the delay, the project will cost 20, 30, 40, 50% more than was originally estimated, and that money may not be recoverable, and the lack of recoverability may itself trigger the loan guarantee.
So in other words, the amount of the total project cost that would put it at risk financially would increase, and that could jeopardize the funding of the project?
Could jeopardize the could draw the taxpayer in through the mechanism of the loan guarantee. Yeah, I mean, if you look at the history of why project cost overruns have occurred in the nuclear industry over 30 years, again and again you'll find that the decision to slow the project down, or the fact that the project was delayed by a construction mishap like the installation of the seismic restraints backward at Diablo Canyon, or the sinking building at Midland, or the quality assurance problems at Zimmer, didn't just add money in the sense that they cost money to be fixed. They added a lot of money in terms of the time value, the interest costs of the borrowed money during the time that the delay played out. So delay is expensive by itself. It doesn't take having the license turned down to create extreme financial difficulty for these projects.
This is Sarah Barzak with Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. I also want to add that at the state level, with the public utility commissions, and I observed this in Georgia with the Public Service Commission there, this loan guarantee carrot, so to speak, was dangled in front of the Georgia Public Service Commissioners as a reason for why they should certify the new Vogtle reactors that Georgia Power was pursuing, because the company argued that their place at the front of the line for these DOE loan guarantees could be at risk if the Public Service Commission didn't pass a construction work in progress, you know, an early cost recovery mechanism, or the certification. So, you know, I'd look at this as another avenue where these loan guarantees, whether they're conditional or not, isn't really the issue for some of these utility commissions. They just, you know, want to ensure that they don't jeopardize the utility in their state's chance of getting these. So just wanted to put that out there as well.
Operator, I believe we have another question in the queue. Let's proceed.
We have a question from Sean Ali of the Environment Reports. Please go ahead.
Yeah, my question is, now that we have this problem with the amended application for the AP, how long might this hold things up? I mean, it sounds like Westinghouse already has plans to create mock-ups and the like to get this thing tested. You know, might this just be a lot of trouble over, you know, a relatively short delay?
This is Ed Lyman. All I can do, you know, is cite Westinghouse's own words, and there is an NRC meeting summary from a meeting that was in July, where Westinghouse indicated that if NRC required any additional testing, it would lead to significant delays. Those are their words, and so I would clearly at that time they were trying to insinuate that NRC could make a decision that would lead to a significant delay in their project, and now they're singing a different tune, trying to reassure potential investors that it's not going to be a big delay. So they've been playing both sides, but I think knowing how these looking, my judgment is looking at the enormous list of difficult, unresolved technical questions, that this is not a small issue, and what will take substantial time to resolve, whether that's 1 year or 3 years, I can't say, but it does look like a big deal to me.
Couldn't Westinghouse or others just go back to the non-amended application that's already been approved?
Well, they could, but they still need to. Well, like I said, they must have had a good reason for going to all this trouble, which I think is cost, but it's really a question for them. But there is this additional monkey wrench in the works, which is the aircraft crash rule, which was put into effect in June of this year. And that is an additional requirement for new reactors that they have to do an analysis of a deliberate aircraft impact and show that certain acceptance criteria are met. And that could lead to the addition of design features or other enhancements. Now, this is actually another significant source of uncertainty, because you can't do that analysis until you know the type of plane you're talking about, how fast it's flying, the direction it may impact your facility and other aspects like that. And none of those have actually been approved yet by the commission. So right now there's no formal or approved guidance for how for the type of aircraft impact. And so you can't even really make the design changes you need until you know what you're trying to protect against. And so it isn't even, but the AP1000 as well as all the other designs are going to ultimately have to address that issue.
It's also not just a matter of sending in a postcard saying, we changed our minds, we're going back to the AP1000 unamended, because you now have the license applications for each of the individual sites that reference something called the AP1000 as amended. So those would all have to be amended as well, which presumably would restart a lot of the licensing clocks. And that in itself is a process that would slow things down quite a bit.
We have time left on the clock for one follow-up question, and I know there are others who are in the queue with other follow-up questions, and we don't in any way, shape, or form mean to ignore you. In fact, we'll talk in a moment about how to facilitate follow-up questions after the next one that we're going to take. So let's take one more follow-up question now, and then we'll explain how any reporters who still have questions can pose them after the news event is over. Operator?
That question comes from William Harrington of Inside Washington Publishers. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks again. I just want to be clear. You're calling for the suspension of the issuance of any new conditional loan guarantees, not just loan guarantees for applications that reference the AP1000 design. Is that correct? And if it is correct, why treat them all the same when it's the AP1000 that appears to have had the most trouble?
This is Peter Bradford. As the point I really want to underline is that what's happened with the AP1000 is just one in a series of obstacles that these Renaissance plants have encountered this year. Keep in mind again that in the last 18 months, more than half of the 26 plants that were said to constitute the Renaissance in the form of licenses pending at the NRC have been canceled or delayed by more than a year, or experienced an upward cost revision of more than $1 billion. All of those events happened before this last week's announcement regarding the AP1000, and it's that series of events, of which the AP1000 is a part, but by no means the entirety, that is why the whole loan guarantee program needs to be rethought.
This is Ed Lyman. Just quickly, of all the other applicants for new reactors, all but one referenced designs that have not yet been certified. And My impression is that there are significant safety issues associated with each one of those that are going to also be difficult to resolve. And if the NRC stance on the AP1000 shield building is any indication, it may be getting more aggressive in requiring the documentation that's needed to resolve some of these difficult issues. So I think we may be seeing more intensive design reviews in the future. For the one design that has already been certified, which is the ABWR, which the South Texas project has referenced in its application, again, that will have to be amended to accommodate an aircraft impact rule. And again, there are a lot of question marks about that.
This is Henry Sokolsky. As part of the work on this Congressional Commission on the Prevention of Weapons of Mass Destruction, Proliferation, and Terrorism, our commission took up the question of possible attacks against reactors. We went over to the NRC, and this was last summer, and we were reassured that this was not an issue that was worth our time. This event here suggests that maybe we should have persisted a bit more on this topic, because it appears as though this is not a closed issue. We were told not to worry about the existing plants, which are grandfathered with regard to this issue, and that the new ones would be fine. Well, it seems to me we need to know that they're fine before we start talking about how we're going to guarantee their financing if they get delayed or they're fouled up in any other way. Why should we put this burden on the taxpayer or excite the humors of utilities to get into projects before we know the most important question having to do with the security of these facilities against terrorist attack? It's just really backwards what's going on here.
And that will conclude the Q&A period. We are now coming up rapidly on the one-hour mark, so what we're going to do at this point is wrap things up. We do want to make sure that you know that if you have questions of the speakers after the news event is over, if you're not able to get a copy of the news release, we want to encourage you to contact Leslie Anderson at 703-276-3256. Again, that's Leslie Anderson at 703-276-3256. You also can find the news release on the web, as well as a related streaming audio replay of this news event for those of you who joined us a few minutes late. You'll be able to find that as of 6 p.m. tonight, along with the news release, which is already available to you on the website for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. That's at cleanenergy.org. Again, www.cleanenergy.org. Again, Leslie Anderson is available to you now to help you at 703-276-3256. You've been listening to a news event sponsored by the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. On behalf of our speakers and everyone at the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, we'd like to thank you for joining us. That concludes this news event.